Hello and welcome to another episode of the CG Garage. This episode is number 131, featuring a really cool guy, Alex Nice. I've known Alex for a while, and apparently I didn't even realize it. I knew him when he first started in visual effects. I didn't realize it was his first job, but he is a very talented guy, done some amazing work. As you will see when you listen to or hear when you listen to the podcast, really cool guy. He's done a lot of stuff in visual effects. And he started doing stuff in VR when he was over at Magnopus, and now is sort of working as an art director and doing some great concept artwork for feature films. And he is, you know, sort of on set doing stuff. So part of the Art Directors Guild. Really cool. Love hanging out with him. We talk about a bunch of stuff, including obviously his career and how things have changed during that time, and VR. We talk about VR a lot because we all have our opinions about it, but I always think it's cool to hear what other people have to say and how they feel about it. And we also go on a little tangent towards the end about sort of our feelings about the situation going on right now with patents, which is very, very interesting because it affects all of us, honestly, especially people in the VR world right now. Patents are going to be a big issue that we'll need to get into. All right, that being said, I want to talk a little bit about what's going on. Obviously, the big news right now, the thing that I'm getting ready for is SIGGRAPH. SIGGRAPH coming up. There's a lot of stuff going on there. I will be sort of in and out. I actually have a ton of different things I need to be attending, so I will not be hosting VUA Days this day. It's going to be Melissa, who's wonderful, and we all know her and love her. But I will be definitely popping in and out as I can, so hopefully I'll see you guys there. And I wanted to tell you some of the talks that are going on because I think it's actually pretty cool. All right. So first thing on the first day, which will be Tuesday, August 1st, and it'll be in room 404A over at SIGGRAPH, which is right sort of there in the middle between the two halls. Chaos Group will be doing an Educators Breakfast, and that's the first thing we'll be doing. We do that every year for people interested in education, understanding the materials we have for people learning V-Ray. It'll go through all of that process with you. Right after that, Dan Akers, VFX supervisor at Blur, who I've known for a long time over at Digital Domain back when he was there, but Dan's a really great guy. Blur will be talking about some of the incredible work they've been doing in Digital Humans and highlighting some of the stuff they did for the Far Cry 5 trailer, which is just incredible Digital Human work. So really, really go and check that out. It'll be awesome. Right after that, Fuse FX will be talking about American Gods, and that will be really cool. Chad is a CG supervisor there, and it will be a really great presentation. So I am looking forward to seeing what Chad has to say about the work they've been doing on American Gods for sure. Right after that will be yours truly, Christopher Nichols. I'll be doing a live CG Garage podcast. Well, live recording, as you guys know. I've gone to events, and I like to go in front of the audience and sort of get the audience participation in the podcast. So the subject of this particular podcast will be the Digital Humans and what's going on over there. And I'll be joined by my good friend Mike Seymour and Jay Bush, who are both very, very smart. Mike Seymour, I'm sure you know, as one of the heads of FX Guide. And Jay Bush now works over at Google, but they are both very involved in Digital Human Project. They are members of the Digital Human League. And we've made a lot of advancements in terms of the Wiki Human Project that are going on right now and can be seen at SIGGRAPH. So keep an eye out for that and come to the podcast with all of your Digital Human questions, because I think we'll have a lot of interesting discussions there. So please come by for that. Right after that, DreamWorks TV will be there, and Maya and Brent will be talking about some of the incredible work they're doing at DreamWorks TV. As you know, if you have kids and you put on Netflix, you'll know there's a ton of content for kids that DreamWorks is putting out all the time. It's just incredible how much work they do. And so a lot of that process is being done over DreamWorks, and they figure out how that works. So if you want to know more about how that kind of content gets made and in such quality and quantity, it should be a good presentation. And that will wrap up day one. On day two, we'll open up with Pixamundo talking about some of the rendering challenges that they've had over time with doing some really big work over there, a lot of big ride stuff, etc. So definitely come by to see Pixo's talk. Right after that, Vlada will be talking about V-Ray past, present, and future. As you guys all know, Vlada has been won the SciTech Academy Award this year, and so we're very happy about that. And so he's been asked to give a little talk about, you know, how he got there and what happened so over the years. And so if you want to sort of go down the history of V-Ray to progress and where it's going in the future, I think it'd be a really exciting thing to see. And then Aaron Sims Creative, which is a great guy. I actually did a podcast with Aaron Sims himself not long ago. You guys may remember that. But they're going to be talking about their sketch to screen. And you may remember, if you listen to the Aaron Sims podcast, what that sketch to screen is. And it, you know, did some amazing work. And they will be mostly talking about Stranger Things and The Mist to Life, which is just fantastic. So very excited to hear that. And that'll be Stefan and Matt who will be talking about that. From Aaron Sims Creative. And let's see, what is that? There's two more talks which are pretty cool as well. Kevin Sears, very good friend of mine over at CG supervisor over at Method. I worked with him back at Digital Domain, and he is really cool. Actually, he and I worked on Tron back then. It was great, sat next to each other. Anyway, so he's over at Method, and he will be talking about the visual effects of Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2, some really great work done on Guardians of the Galaxy. I'm excited to see that one for sure. And then the last talk, but certainly not least, by far, it's Digital Domain talking about creating the Beast on Beauty and the Beast. Jeremy Butel, who is a CG supervisor there, and I work with Jeremy at DD for a while. He's a really cool guy, and of course, Darren Hendler, DFX supervisor there. Darren is an amazing guy. Really knows a lot about humans, digital humans, character work, and has been involved in that at Digital Domain for a while. So that will be a great talk to wrap it up with. So very excited to have them as well. Hopefully I can get Jeremy and Darren to be on a podcast on their own. So we'll try to see if I can figure that out. Anyway, those are the talks. There'll be a lot more announcements going on. If you want to know more and want a refresher to say, where do I get all this information? chaosgroup.com/SIGGRAPH2017. So go check it out. Lots of cool stuff. Hopefully we'll see you at SIGGRAPH, and it'll be a lot of fun. With that being said, let's get on the show with Alex Nice. All right. Thanks, guys.
Welcome to another CG Garage where the Chaos Group talks. You'll know it's over when the last bucket drops. We're gonna fire off rays in high dynamic range. We know that ambient occlusion is passe. Global illumination won't lead you astray. And while image-based lighting is really swell, you need to make sure everything has Fresnel.
So what do you want to start with? Do you want to start talking about patents, or do you want to start talking about your history?
We'll do the patents later. I've already like relaxed. My anger is already left. My passion.
Right. Well, let's do. Let's talk about our past and where we was. Was Sway the first place we met?
It is. Yeah,
that which was is my first like place. A half a block away from here.
It is. Yeah, it's right around the corner.
Right.
And that was a nice building too, man. Mm-hmm. Remember those pearl floors and everyone riding around on the razors and everything?
Yes. Yeah. That was, so it was an Eric Owen Moss building for the architects who listen, which is kind of a nice building. And then we had the top floor, but then Mark wanted to have these white, shiny floors.
Yeah. Like mirror shiny,
like,
right?
Like mirror shiny, yeah. Like with as few dents as possible in them, yep, at all. And he put these down, and then since there were these, it was a long hallway down to the end. Mm-hmm. We all brought like razor scooters,
yeah,
and started scooting down this beautiful hallway,
right?
Because it was so slick.
Mm-hmm. it was like my entrance into LA was like, all right, so I guess this is how it always is. But it was never like that ever again.
No, well, yeah, sometimes. So was that your first LA job?
It was. Yeah, I went down there, and I remember you guys were there. It was very cleanly like the A squad and the B squad, and I was part of the B squad, and you guys were in this like room of superstars. And I remember kind of peeking in, kind of see what's going on, and then
we were a ceiling cat room, is what you're talking about.
Yeah, and then there was the first one I remember was we were doing some kind of like Nissan. Everything was like glossy metal environment, and it was right. It looked horrific, in my opinion.
Okay.
And then, but when I peek over in your office, and you guys were doing this Subaru ad, all right. That I remember, like, blew my mind. Like, it was like the car was like flying out of magazines and landing into other pages, and right. I was like, oh man, okay, so I gotta up my game a little bit.
But what were you, how did you get into, so if that was your first job in LA, how the hell did we find you?
Yeah, well, to get to, you want me to start from kind of, can
sure.
I start from the beginning? Okay,
whatever you want.
So originally, when I first got into 3D, my first entrance into 3D was actually 3D Studio version 1. So my mom,
was it 3D Studio Max?
No, 3D Studio.
So on DOS.
My, yes.
So
my,
we're talking about 1992?
End of grade school, I think middle school a little bit. So
wow, how did you get access to it that young?
So my family life is that my mom and dad had me very early. Mm-hmm. My mom kind of, after they got divorced, my mom went to Marin and kind of went through this tech industry.
So
path.
This is in California.
California, okay. Northern California, Bay Area. And she went down this tech industry path, and my dad kind of stayed in suburban Concord, California, which mm-hmm. is just suburban hell kind of thing.
Okay.
And so I'd go back and forth on the weekends, but my mom was at Autodesk when they invented Max, or 3D Studio, I mean. So she was
well,
there.
Well, the Autodesk was not owned by 3D Studio was not owned by Autodesk at that
like
time.
Like version 2 or 1. One of those. Like
right,
at
okay.
a certain point,
yes,
it combined.
Yes.
It was, I think it went,
it was owned
became
by
Kinetics later on.
Kinetics and Yoast Group was the first company that made
correct.
It.
Correct. Yeah. And then they came into AutoCAD,
right.
Autodesk. I yep. think maybe version 2 then, maybe not 1.
Maybe 3. I don't know. Actually, I remember.
I feel like
Kinetics.
It was 2 because I had 2 was on my first
computer.
Because
it was bought by whatever. We can look at the history, but I think Kinetics was basically bought them their own Flame.
Okay, yeah.
And they put combustion as part of that, and that's why combustion and Max started to work closer together.
Okay, yeah, I remember that.
And then
that
I
was
think,
during Max.
And then
right?
Kinetics got bought by Autodesk. This is my memory, but I could be wrong.
So my recollection is that it was under 3D Studio first,
okay,
or under Autodesk first. 3D Studio was,
right.
And then my earliest memory is kind of walking in the hallways as they were doing like
right.
showing me 3D Studio version 2 with the 2D editor, the 3D Lofter, and
yes.
And the 3D animator,
yeah.
all that stuff. So I was playing around in there, and I was actually.
And how old were you? So you're like in middle school.
Yeah, kid, like I super young, and it's all blurs together the timeline. But I
sure.
think it was like around the time that a Lawnmower Man was out. There was no Jurassic Park or anything,
yeah, yeah,
and
yeah.
it was like 3D was, you know, you'd see it here and there, and we had it on our old. My mom's computer was a 386,
uh-huh.
so we had it on there, and so I
yeah.
would draw 2D images with the 2D editor
uh-huh.
as a kid, and think of it as a 2D thing, and then they'd show me like a little bit of 3D stuff, and like the circle extrude, and like what are you talking about,
right.
and everything, and then I'd switch over to Myst and play Myst for a little while on
right.
CD-ROM. So I did that, and then that was my first 3D, and then I stopped, and also on my dad's computer. Also, I had a 3D Studio on my dad's computer on like a 286 or something.
Wow.
And then I remember my first scene that I rendered at my dad's house took like a week and a half, and it was like a race car through the environment. And right. there was that turbo button that I kept pushing down to try to get it to render a little bit faster.
The turbo button.
You remember that on
yeah.
the 286s? The light goes on. You take the computer apart. Just a wire attached to a light.
It does nothing.
Nothing.
Why
else.
Would it ever be off?
Yeah. Right. You don't overheat the power grid or anything.
Yeah.
Yeah, so then that was my first 3D as a kid, and I used it a lot. Like, it was kind of like, because I was isolated going to my mom's house all the time in
sure.
Marin, so that's when I learned that. And then I dropped off at 3D for a while, and then in school I was kind of like, I went through my you know, the phase where you're like kind of, what's the word?
Rebel?
Yeah, rebel. But I was tattooing through high school, so I did a lot of tattoos. With
really?
I was hanging. I got kicked out of high school, went to continuation school, and then got kicked out of that one. Was like using a prison gun, like tattooing all over town and everything. And
wow.
There's a lot of really bad tattoos that exist in the Bay Area because of me. Yeah, there's a couple offset tribal tattoos that are in the wrong spot, and there's all kinds of. I have horrible mistake stories.
Wow.
But yeah, so I did that. And then when I finally got my shit together in junior college, I took my first 3D class, which was 3D Studio Max at that point.
Okay.
I was like, whoa, this is crazy. It's really,
it's gotten a lot
yeah.
better. Yeah, the jump from 3D Studio to Max was huge.
Yeah, it was amazing. Like the last thing I remember doing in 3D Studio, and I think it was released 4, was the using the reflection map to try to mimic the T1000.
Right.
And that was like, that was where I left it off. And then coming back to Max was like, insane. And all the plugins. Remember, it came with a little book called Digimation Book of Plugins
yes,
you can buy.
Yes,
so
yes.
Yeah, so I got back in that. But because I was so like comfortable with 3D Studio as a kid, I excelled in that class like beyond everyone else.
Right, because you already like the concepts were at least.
Totally. Like it was like it wasn't like natural. So everyone had done these like kind of like animations of like a sphere rolling on the floor.
Right.
And I had done this like, and I've never done an animation this long before in my life. It was like a 2-minute animation of going to the moon through a wormhole and an alien grabbed you with a tentacle. And people, the whole class was like, what is this? So then the teacher kind of pulled me aside after the class, is like, hey, I think I have a buddy of mine's looking for work. Do you want to work in 3D?
Right.
And so what he did was he hooked me up with a company in the Bay Area that was courtroom simulations, reenactment for accidents, like that's airplane accidents, car accidents, and train accidents.
It's so funny. You're the third person that had a start in legal animation.
Yeah. I mean, I loved it. I mean, people look at it and they're like, that's really macabre. And for me, that was like, it was like insane because you felt like an investigator, like before CSI. Because a lot of the stuff that the 3D stuff did was it allowed you to kind of like focus on field of view issues. Like if you're driving and if you go to a scene and you measure a scene, we'd close off like intersections in San Francisco. Mm-hmm. I'd measure it out, and being the main 3D artist, I would kind of like build out the scenes, and then we'd put the car through the intersection, and then you find out, wow, this bush, which was not trimmed, blocked your field of view, and that's why this person hit this person, right? So you'd get kind of like, it was like a discovery process that was felt meaningful compared to whatever crappy jobs I had before that.
Right.
I did that for about 3 years, and I was on CNN, and I got to do a lot of cool stuff there as just a kid at like, you know, 22 years old or something like that. 18, I don't know.
So you did stuff for CNN?
No, CNN came and did a story on our office because our office, the claim to fame that our office did was it dealt with the Italian fighter pilot that had hit, or the American fighter pilot that had hit the Italian gondola. Do you remember that in the early 90s? There was a gondola going between some snow-capped mountains, and the American pilot, the military plane, was kind of hot-dogging through the mountain range, and it clipped a cord, and the whole gondola fell, and everyone kind of perished.
Wow. So, okay, I didn't know that.
So that story was, you know, 60 Minutes did a story on it and everything. So
and then they came to you to
To see what we were doing. And we were doing like a lot of big accidents. There was a lot of bus accidents and train accidents. And,
oh, weird.
You know, it was almost like a Hollywood production, because you would go to the scene. If it was a train accident, you would get onto the train and kind of set up cameras in the conductor's point of view. Mm-hmm. And then we'd go down the tracks to see if you would see that kid on the tracks and things like that.
Oh,
or
wow.
We'd close down entire like Market Street areas in San Francisco. And so it was a lot of money being spent. During that time for the courtroom stuff. So I did that for about 4 years while kind of part-time going to art school at night. So I was already doing 3D professionally, sort of, like more like sterile 3D.
Sure.
And then taking fine art classes and illustration classes at the Academy in San Francisco.
Right.
And so I did that for about, but I was taking classes at the Academy. I didn't take their curriculum. I took only classes that I was interested in.
Right.
So after about 3.5 years of going there.
Your degree didn't really matter.
Yeah. But I talked to the counselor, and I was like, so when am I going to graduate? Like, I must be doing really good. They're like, you are never graduating. You are only taking classes that you're interested in.
Right.
And I'd taken some matte painting classes, fine art, tons of fine art stuff and everything. And I was like, well, all right, I guess it's time for me to go because I can't afford you anymore.
Right.
So I left, and then right about that time, one of my buddies,
doesn't even matter, by the way.
Yeah, what,
the fact that you didn't graduate?
Yeah, no, I'm so glad that I did that, actually, because the painting actually came more in handy later on than the actual learning where the buttons were in like Maya or something like that. One of the people that was in my original 3D studio class in junior college, who's my best friend, he is now a lead creature modeler at ILM.
Oh, really?
And cool. He was at Sway also on just a really short gig. And he's like, I know someone in the Bay
Who
Area.
Is this?
His name's Daniel Moy.
Okay.
He's in Vancouver.
Okay.
And he recommended me, and they called me, and they're like, do you want to work on a car commercial?
Yeah.
And I was like, yeah, I do. I'm in the Bay Area. And then so I actually like flew down to Sway to work on this job. And I think I was paid like peanuts.
Right.
And I had to pay for my own hotel, my own rent a car.
Okay.
So I made no money on this job. Right. I came down here and I stayed in like some seedy hotel over there in South LA.
Okay.
And I was driving every day, and I sat down and like learned V-Ray and AOVs and everything on the spot. And
just, well, you pulled it off.
I faked it till I made it, basically. Yeah. And I was like sitting there and I sat next to, do you remember Curtis Cardwell?
Of course.
And he's like,
oh, Jesus.
Yeah, that was my first entrance.
The drama.
But he was great because he was like, all right, listen, this is what you got to do, man. Just do this. And like, yeah. And when they walk by, I'd be like, yeah, I'm working on the light. Like, he was like showing, I was like, yeah, I could do
showing this. You how to bullshit?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, he was great, man. I can't thank him enough for that.
Curtis and Mike Wall, like the little bickering fights they used to have. Right. It was awesome. It was like watching a sitcom with these two characters.
Yeah, about like cigarettes and everything. Yeah.
Whatever. So much fun.
Yeah.
So much fun. No, yeah, they were, and what was her name? Claudia?
Yeah, Claudia. Yeah.
Claudia. I haven't talked to her.
We're friends on Facebook.
Really?
Yeah, she seems to be doing good. She's always traveling to some like really amazing places.
Yeah, she's the most unusual Peruvian Chinese person I've ever met.
Yeah. Yeah, those are good times, man.
Yeah. That was really fun. It was a blast.
Yeah.
It was a blast.
Yeah. So then after that, I flew back down a couple times. I guess they liked me.
Did you work on that Toyota Corolla miniature thing that we did?
No, I did I think the most challenging one, the best one that I was happy with was the Nissan Rogue.
Oh, which was this. That was Wayne England's thing.
Yes, it was. And it was, and that one actually I really shined on because it was a challenge because it was abstract. It wasn't like drawing through a city. It was like the environment was projected CG screens of projections. And it was really interesting. Like, developing the look. And there was like a kind of like a moment where I was doing an interactive with Mark trying to figure out like what it looked like, so I drew while the whole like team was like watching me draw and stuff. So that was a good gig. But from there, on that job, I met Mark Rienzo.
Oh, right, of course.
And then that was basically the entrance in because Mark contacted me a few months later while I was in Berkeley just dicking off, and he was like, "Hey, I'm souping on a show like a little earthquake movie called 2012. You guys want to come down?" And I was like, and I had just gotten out of this like crazy long relationship that I was with in Berkeley, California. And I was basically married. And so I had like weed whackers and lawnmowers, and I was doing the like suburban life, and I was like, I'm done with everything. I put it all on the port or on the curb, and I said free, and no one got it. And then I put $5 on everything, and then everyone in Oakland came and stole everything.
Right.
and then so I just packed up my one car and I drove down here, and then I'm going to start on 2012.
Wow.
Yeah. So it was kind of a quick jump between.
Did you work for, I guess, so Mark was over at Uncharted, I guess.
He was, that's where it was at. Yeah.
Right. So
and you guys were at DD at the same time, right? Doing the.
I knew Mark from DD. Like, I think he and I worked on Day After Tomorrow together. Yeah. Like, I've known him for years.
One of the best compers out there.
Yeah. I think it's actually kind of hard to argue. Like, he is one of the best compers out there. I think Sonia Bouchard is actually up there as well, but I don't think she comps much anymore. Sonia just got into the Academy. I was actually going to say something.
Oh, cool.
So she's awesome. Anyway, but Mark is awesome. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Really smart guy and one of the best. I'd say best compositor, but like really, like there's no one that knows that can do Nuke as good as he can.
Yeah, it was incredible. Back then, yeah,
yeah, and so he was so cool. So he went to Uncharted, which was at the Sony lot at the time, right?
It was, and I almost want to call it Sway 2.0 because I was surrounded by everyone at Sway.
Right,
and it was like we all knew each other.
Yep,
and we went in there, and it. I mean.
Eric Sheely was there.
Everyone.
Justin Magel was there as well.
It was Justin Magel's move from Michigan,
Michigan, yeah. Over there. He's back in Michigan now.
Yep. Yeah, it was just a great team. And, you know, we were really passionate because it was our first movie. And, you know, you saw the dailies and, you just thought that this was going to be like the Academy Award winning movie of – I mean,
maybe
to me at the time, I was like, this is going to change the world.
I survived Day After Tomorrow. So I knew I was like, man, it's the same thing.
But I mean, you got to give credit also to Mark Wagger and
Volker
Engel because they, you know,
a lot
of these big companies, they just kind of pull, like we're pulling in people with experience, but Mark, because they're just like, they're so brilliant. They're so open. They pull in people that, and they kind of like groom them for the position.
Yep.
It was like game changing. It made like careers for so many people that I'm still friends with today.
Absolutely. I mean, I think he's got a very interesting way of running a visual effects company. And for those of you who are listening, go back to listen to the Volker Engel podcast I did with him because it's really fascinating, the whole idea of how Uncharted works, you know, the way it scales up, scales down. And some people are like, well, it's kind of bullshit. You just basically bankrupt a company at the end of every thing, essentially.
Well, when you look at the time frame of when that was going on,
right.
The studios there were these giant corporate entities. Like, right. They were these, I mean, not giant, but they were big companies that seemed almost impossible to get into. Mm-hmm. And they had their own software and everything. Yep. And there was this company that was like using off-the-shelf software.
Off-the-shelf computers.
Off everything. Like, it was just, what is it, pull yourself by the bootstraps or something like that. And it was amazing. Like, people like falling over each other just to get this job done. That was a great time to be in VFX, I think, in general, because it was so incredible.
I loved it. So you went on 2012, and then what happened after that?
Yeah, so I went on as a generalist and as a modeler. And as I was even doing this job, like, it was awesome and like it was a dream come true, and I was kind of getting used to being in LA and everything. And, you know, these people were coming in, and it was like a big corral of artists in a giant open area. Mm-hmm. And then the map painters would come in, and they're like, you know, they had like turtlenecks on, and they're like walking through the room.
Fancy pants guys.
Yeah. And you see them, you're like, what are they doing? And then they got their own office, and it was all, you know, like around the corner, and it was just like this mysterious thing. And so I like peeked my head in like about 2/3 of the way through the production. It was a pretty long production, I think mm-hmm. a year and a half or something. Mm-hmm. And you know, I just kind of talked with them and was like working with them and expressed interest in matte painting. Uh-huh. And that's where I met Ivo Horvat mm-hmm. and Michelle Moen mm-hmm. And Rick Rishi. And they were in there matte painting a lot of the Vegas sequence for 2012.
Right.
And it was, well, we were on the LA sequence, which was like the destruction of a lot of residential buildings. And it was on street level, which is incredibly difficult to do at that detail mm-hmm. Quality. On, you know, slow machines and everything like that. And then you walked in and you see that three people were doing this entire Vegas destruction sequence using Photoshop and low res geometry. And my mind was like blown. Like, I couldn't even believe that you could do that. And I was just like, kind of like, you know, like peeking in and trying to like see how to get in there. Cause I had taken a matte painting class in mm-hmm. back at the academy. And and Ivo Horvat, like, he was amazing also. He was like, yeah, we can give you a shot, give you a try. And again, thanks to Volker and Mark, they're like, yeah, let him see if he can do it. And they,
so I mean, kind of them.
How, like, that's so amazing. Like, to me, that's like, that was like the main point in my career where I like everything kind of changed, because they let me re-interview and I told them I could do matte painting and I pulled up some of my old stuff. And then I got to learn on the job matte painting for a very expensive movie right there. And that was like the pivotal moment of my career, really.
Right.
And I, even my first matte painting was just, I think I spent like, what was it? Like 2 weeks on a house, on some destroyed houses off in the background, mm-hmm. 2 weeks just painting some houses there every day, just painting like the nails on the fences and stuff. And then in the end, you know, they put smoke over everything and you never saw it. So they were patient with me, and it was just like, it was so cool.
Right.
And I mean, Ivo like was like an open book, and he taught me like the fundamentals of 3D matte painting, and that, because the assumption is that matte painting is just 2D drawing mm-hmm. In Photoshop, and then the compers will make it work.
Layer it somehow.
Yeah. And then in there, we were like modeling out with the projections on the geometry, like hundreds of layers, and then doing every single 2D trick. And you got, the result was like an ILM quality almost shot mm-hmm. by three people, like with very little resources to mm-hmm. actually do it. It was really cool. And so I did that, and then I matte painted for the rest of the job, doing Vegas, kind of destroyed cliffs and destroyed casinos. Mm-hmm. And then I was a matte painter from there on out.
Yeah.
Next 10 years.
Yeah. So next 10 years, you're a matte painter. What's some of the projects that are memorable to you?
Elysium was great. Pacific Rim.
Oh, right. Elysium. Right.
I bounced around at little studios. I wanted to do, 2012 was a really long project. Uh-huh. And what I tried to kind of do, and I feel like a little bit successfully, I think, is that I tried to come in towards the end of these projects and kind of fill in where I was needed instead of go through a 2-year process.
Right.
So over a span of like 5 years, I was able to do like Oblivion, tons of movies, like a lot of movies all mm-hmm. at once. And so I do like a few paintings on Oblivion, Pacific Rim, Elysium. I don't know, they're all escaping me right now, but mm-hmm. they did a bunch of them. And it was just kind of going around to different studios and kind of learning their pipelines. And then it was really good education of how different studios work and seeing how everything was.
Right.
It was cool, yeah. And then I even went up to Vancouver for a couple jobs, like Tron. I was on Tron for a summer.
Yeah, were you in DD?
Prime Focus.
Prime Focus, yes.
And yeah, in the matte painting department there. Mm-hmm. And I spent a summer out there in the freezing cold rain. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it was cool.
Yeah. And then eventually you and I ran into each other again when I went visiting Magnopus over... You know, downtown, right?
Yeah. So, okay, that's right. So on, I went, one of my jobs that I did was on Hugo at Pixelmondo.
Right.
And so at Pixelmondo, I was not working at the time, and Pixelmondo called me and they were like, how would you like to work on Transformers? And I was like, I would like to work on this Transformers. So it was just down the street because I was living over on the waterfront in Venice, right there behind the waterfront cafe.
Yeah.
And so I rode my bike over there and I'm all like stoked for the job. And they sat down and they're like, all right, you're going to be matte painting for a Transformers toy commercial for Mattel.
My God.
And so I did that and it was rough, man. It was like, you know, kids like, oh my God, Optimus Prime and doing all that stuff.
Wow.
And I was...
What a switch.
It was a real switch and bait there.
A bait and switch.
Bait and switch. And, and so I did that. But while I was doing that, Ben Grossman came by and he's like, hey, you're Matt Painter. Do you want to work on this Scorsese thing? And I was like, yes, I do. And
yes.
I think he even had me do a test where I like painted something and then to show them that I can do it. And then he pulled me into the Hugo room. And then we worked on Hugo for about 8 months, I believe.
Yeah.
And it was awesome. Also another like pivotal job that really like was amazing.
Yeah.
Ben Grossman is, if you don't know him, he's brilliant, right? So he's
been on the podcast, so you should listen to that one.
Yeah. He's an incredible VFX supervisor. And he was like, I've never seen someone who basically was so busy dealing with so many shots in such a short amount of time, and he'd walk by your monitor and he'd be like, what you need to do is, you know, change it here, change this, it needs to be a little warm here, a little cool here, and like these quick little adjustments, and then walk away and you're like looking at it like, dude, he just tore this apart, but he's right. And then I would fix it.
Right.
And it was like, I did a couple shots on there and it was like, it was a great job also.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that we kind of had a good relationship from there. So when, I think about 3 years ago, a little bit over 3 years ago, we all kind of, about a group of about eight of us, were the original founding members of Magnopus.
Okay.
So that's where
he started Magnopus, and you went along with those founding members, right?
Yeah, he called me and he kind of gave me a pitch of what the company was going to be. Mm-hmm. And so I came in there as an art director, and then, we got this, you know, you've been there. It's the top floor of this like amazing art deco building in downtown LA, and it's like overlooking like the streets and Pershing Square, and it's awesome.
It's you walk in there, it feels like you're going into Q's office on the on a James Bond movie.
Totally, yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's hard not to walk in there and be like, all right, I've made it. I guess I'll invest in oil or something.
That's right.
it's an amazing office.
Yeah.
And so we started in there, and over a span of 3 years, I did some visual effects supervising on some music video stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I did some film concept development work, some previs work on Jungle Book, and heavily invested into VR. And the company kind of shifted over from film and more into the VR world as that kind of took a hold.
Well, they're kind of an unusual company.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not always very clear how to describe them.
It's really difficult to describe.
It's like they're a company that is interested in where something's going to go rather than actually just doing production work.
Yeah, because they're totally forward-thinking guys. And what I like to say is they, you know, in VFX, you are a problem solver also.
Mm-hmm.
You're basically, every single job you're on,
there's
not an answer for what you're doing. You're on the spot trying to solve issues in VFX. And that kind of skill set translates to a lot of places in the tech sector as well. And what we did there was we're applying visual effects principles to VR development, which was a huge, I think one of the first Vive sets or one of the first companies with the Vive sets in LA. And the stuff that we were doing there was pretty interesting for the amount of people that were there. It was pretty crazy. They continue to do it also. I did a little bit of work on this, but there while we were doing the space station ISS VR experience.
Right. That's online now.
Have you tried that?
I did.
It's pretty impressive.
It is cool. It is really cool.
Yeah. It's they worked with NASA and right. they basically built out the modules of the ISS.
Yep, and they had astronauts sort of validate everything they were doing.
There's a video online of it. I think an astronaut talking about how he was kind of like moved to almost tears when he put it on because it reminded him of when he was in space. And I sent that to Ben. And he was like, "Yep,
yep, that's cool." I think I'm really happy for what those guys are doing. And there's obviously really nice guys there. And Sally Slade is there. And
Alex Henning.
Alex and some really, really, really good guys. But you left because you got some interesting opportunity. You just couldn't pass, right?
When I was there, I got contacted by a director on a film at Fox, and he asked me to be one of the main concept designers for a film that's coming out next year.
Yeah.
I've been trying for a number of years. As much as I love the map painting, I love even more the design and pre-production concept illustration kind of stuff. So that was my opportunity. I just randomly out of the blue got contacted by a director. He's like, "I want you on this movie." And I said, I'm not in the Art Director Guild. And the guild, I don't know if you know, but to get into the guild is very difficult in
LA.
And yeah, and so, but on every movie, you're allowed to superstar one person. And so the way that that works is that when you go in, the production designer, the director, and the producer have to essentially write a letter to the guild to get you approved into the process. Okay. So, and that's incredibly rare because obviously they're busy people, and to have them like apply for your membership to the guild is not on the top of their list.
Sure.
And so they superstarred me in, and then so I was able to get into the guild in one shot.
That's amazing.
And, oh yeah.
Because I know a lot of, I've had some guys here that are in the guild. There's Fausto Di Martini mm-hmm. and David Levy. I'm trying to get Ben Proctor in because he and I are old friends. Mm-hmm. But yeah, and I know that process is challenging, and getting in is a challenge. But being in the guild is a big deal now.
It's
really cool. So that's awesome that you're doing that.
Yeah, thank you. It's exciting. You know,
now I know you can't necessarily talk about the project so much, but it has got to be. You were sort of telling me about the idea of like you do a concept design and then they physically build it.
Yeah, that's probably the highlight of my entire career has been in the past 3 months also is where I'll do a design at my desk and I'll draw in Photoshop and I'll use Max and V-Ray and render it out and get them to look at it, and then it's approved, and then you know you do concept work as a map painter and then okay, we'll see how that goes, and that's the concept art. But this is a situation where I do the concept art, it gets approved, and then I walk onto the stage next door a month later, and I'm walking in my designs. They've got guys working around the clock building out these sets, and these are multi
with your renderings as reference.
Yeah, they're taped to the wall, and they're building it out. And you're seeing your own concept art in the real world is probably the greatest moment.
Yeah.
that I've ever had in this.
That's
industry.
Amazing.
So, yeah, it's incredible.
That's awesome.
Yeah, and they're like multi-million-dollar sets, and they're there and they're working, and you know it's. And the other thing, you know, I'll talk briefly about is the VR stuff I did for that.
Yeah, tell me what you can say about that.
Because of my history of using VR at Magnopus, I'm pretty versatile in kind of the development and the VR stuff. Mm-hmm. And so since I'm a 3D/2D artist, I would draw it in Photoshop or I'd model it in Max, mm-hmm. and then I would export everything out and shade it in Unreal. Mm-hmm. And then since I brought my Vive headset into the art department, mm-hmm. the director would kind of daily come over to my desk, put on the headset, and walk around in my virtual sets even way before they're even built.
Right.
That was huge because what happened was he was making decisions and big calls right there at my desk. So
in real scale,
because you have spatial awareness in VR.
Yes.
So when you're there walking around in these sets, like one thing I remember is like it's a sci-fi movie, and so in this kind of control room, the ceiling is I think about 8 feet off the ground or 10 feet off the ground, mm-hmm. and he's in there in VR and he's walking and he's holding up his hands, figuring out where he's gonna, or he's walking around the set and he's kind of figuring out where he's gonna shoot from for mm-hmm. these kind of dialogue scenes, mm-hmm. and then he's realizing that the ceiling is too high and he wants it lower to really make it a little bit more confining and feeling a little bit bring the emotion up a little bit. Mm-hmm. And so right there, he's like, "Can you bring the ceiling down?" So I'll move it there while he's in VR or take it out and then put him back in. I'll move it down, and then he'll sit there and like, yes, right there. This is the spot that I want it.
Awesome.
No, that's a $15,000 change on a set if you're going to move the whole ceiling down to do this. So, right. Like we did that daily.
Or you don't move the ceiling and it doesn't look as good.
Yeah, or you tell him no. But that happened every day. Like we had I did an escape vehicle in the movie, mm-hmm. and in this vehicle, you sit. You could, like, it's a little escape pod, essentially, mm-hmm. I can say that. And it's a chair. And so I would essentially put a soapbox down in the middle of the room and then in VR, put the vehicle there. Mm-hmm. And so I'd sit the director on a soapbox in the real world, but in VR, he's sitting in the vehicle looking at it and saying, I want a handle right here. I want a handle here. I mm-hmm. want it to be a little bit more spacious here. So he's making spatial layout decisions, global decisions to this project. And only with the illustrator in the room. And it's like, that's a game changer in production,
yes.
I think.
And then when they build it for real, then it'll be right.
Yeah, absolutely. It was huge. It's really exciting stuff to me.
See, basically, that's the same things that I've been saying about architecture, right? You and I had a little bit of, since we just got back from lunch, you and I talking a little bit about this. I was like, I really believe that VR is going to be critical to making decisions about things that aren't built.
Absolutely. The key thing here for like VR and for what I was doing is, you have to go in and out. What you need is communal VR. So you can all be in there at the same time to have discussions, like a daily session almost.
Sure.
And then you need, you also need to the ability to kind of modify it in VR there to make the call while you're in there, basically.
Sure.
And I think they already have these things kind of in development.
Sure. So. I mean, it's interesting. I had this conversation and you've had enough experience in VR that I think that you and I can have this discussion. Someone was talking about VR and architecture and the points that it's going to be, and they wrote an article about it, and there was a question about, whether design will change in VR. Now, I don't, and people find it strange that I feel this way, but I feel that absolutely in the scenario that you just laid out as the director of the movie, right, mm-hmm. who's there looking at things like, no, this door handle is not the right place. I want this. You're showing him what it would be in real scale. Mm-hmm. But do you really see yourself modeling in VR with the headset on?
No, I think what's going to happen for the film side is it's very similar to games, to where things are modular, right? You have, and Unreal is doing this where you have kind of like an asset browser in VR, and you can kind of move these things around and make small non-uniform scaling changes to those things.
Sure.
But I don't think you're going to be modeling so much.
Right. Because I had this thing where, there was this discussion about, what was it called? Tom Cruise movie with the murder thing and the sci-fi's. Why am I name blanking on it? Minority Report.
I always name blank that movie.
I know. Minority Report.
Yeah.
Sorry. Anyway, Minority Report, there was like the interface that he did and he was moving things around. And, right. and it was like, that's the future. That's going to be interface.
Yeah.
Well, guess what? They tried to do something like that. Mm-hmm. Turns out it's really, really tiring.
Yeah. Right.
Moving your arms around like that all day long.
Yeah.
It's going to wipe you out.
Yeah.
And if you're modeling at full scale and you're trying to move boxes and doing things, I'm not going to be crouching down all day long modeling.
I have a good story.
I'm
going to
sit at a chair with a mouse and a keyboard.
Minimal movements.
Right.
I have a funny story about that. While I was at Magnopus, Facebook contacted us and asked me if I would go to Facebook Connect in Silicon Valley at the Facebook conference and sculpt in VR on stage in their program Medium. I don't know if you've used Medium. It's basically like a watered down ZBrush in VR.
Okay.
So you have a piece of clay and you can spatially see it. So
right.
I think modeling there is pretty interesting. So I basically got their beta and practiced on that for about a week and a half. Mm-hmm. So every night I was sculpting in VR and, my wife's watching me in my boxers just standing there and she's like, why did I even marry this guy? And so I'm sitting there sculpting and like you say, you're exhausted sculpting in VR because you're actually lifting your hand to and not getting any contact on a piece of clay. You're just
Even rest your hand on a sculpture.
So the thing is about me is I got kind of a big belly. So I find myself like naturally resting my arm on my gut to keep my hand steady and sculpting that way, which I'm sure like in the real world looked just horrific. Right. But that's the way I'm able to keep my hand steady, because at a certain amount of time, my hand starts shaking from,
yes.
I mean, 2 hours in VR is a long time. So at a certain point.
That's the point I'm making. I don't think that's going to be a thing. Everyone seems to be thinking you're going to be designing full pieces of architecture in VR. It's like, that's exhausting. That sounds like construction to me. That doesn't sound like modeling.
There's pros and cons, right? Because, I think people water down the importance of the kind of like the spatial awareness that you have in VR.
Absolutely. I'm certainly not dismissing this, because I think I see it as a validation. Mm-hmm. You're modeling it. Practically, we've gotten some really good tools that allow you to do some amazing technical stuff, ZBrush, modeling in Max, Revit, whatever your tool happens to be, and then putting the VR headset and validating what you've just done.
Yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm. But, well, I mean, I'm friends with Neville Page, so we were talking about this. Neville Page is like this incredible creature modeler from Aliens and Tron and stuff. Uh-huh. And I'm talking with him, and what I was trying to explain was that in VR, when you're sculpting, it's like you have clay in front of you. And because you have spatial awareness, what you'll notice is that when you use ZBrush, you sculpt a little brush stroke, you rotate, you sculpt again. When you rotate that model after every brush stroke, what you're doing is you're calibrating your mind to kind of see if the proportions and things are correct, right?
Right.
When you're in VR, that is not needed, because you have stereo vision with spatial awareness.
And also you're just constantly slowly moving all the time anyway.
Yeah, but seeing it there, if you're doing a nose on a character, you don't have to look at a profile view and rotate around to see if it's right. You can see if that nose looks correctly looking straight on at that character. Mm-hmm. So having that spatial awareness will apply also to the architecture stuff, because you'll want to, you know, a lot of times when you create this art, emotion is the important thing there. You want to get an impact of what's there. Mm-hmm. And on a 2D rectangle that you're looking at a monitor, you're trying to find that emotion that you don't get in the real world. And VR does bridge that gap a little bit.
Interesting. Yeah, I just still think practically it's going to be hard.
Well, what do you think about the combination of VR? So where you're wearing the headset, but you're using your mouse at the desk. So you're standing there, but you can look, you're not a monitor, you're sitting there in the middle of your environment.
I think that's possible. Mm-hmm. I'd almost say, and this is something that I think my friend Scott Metzger would agree with, and this is the only time I've sort of agreed with him on some things. Mm-hmm. That's not true. We fight a lot, but he's really bright. But I never, he had this thing where he made a workstation inside of VR, like it's a computer inside of VR.
Right.
And you're sitting at the desk and you're using the computer in VR.
Right.
And I'm like, why the fuck would you do that? Mm-hmm. You have a computer, just use the damn computer, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And now that you say exactly what you said, that actually makes sense. What if I had a computer in VR and I was building the building, and the building that I'm building is building itself around me at the same time?
Right. So you kind of,
so I have a mouse and
hybrid,
keyboard,
right?
Yeah. I have a mouse and keyboard. I'm like making adjustments and seeing it happen around me in real time.
Yeah.
That would be kind of super meta.
Yeah. I mean, it's a new world. We get to see
But it would solve the problem of me like walking over and like moving my hands and like doing the, well, you
stepping
know,
on your cat.
Stepping on your cat, or embarrassing yourself in your boxers and your VR headset in your house while your wife is trying to make coffee.
Yeah, exactly. So many bad stories.
Yeah. But I think that modeling and designing and architecture is not quite the sculpting, like ZBrush. The way you describe ZBrush, it's like, yeah, I get it. Mm-hmm. But in architecture, you don't have to constantly check.
Right.
Also, that actually depends on the kind of architecture you're doing. If you're, you know, someone like Patrick Schumacher at Zaadi, they design things very spatially.
Yeah.
So it could be a benefit there.
I mean, I could see a process where you would, essentially in games, it's a gray boxing phase. Mm-hmm. You lay out through cubes or very simple primitives the layout that gets you the spatial thing that you want out of VR.
Right.
And then going back into the traditional process to do the real
work. Yeah, I can see that.
So, yeah, making those because, you know, there's just a disconnect by looking at a monitor versus getting spatial awareness is what I think is the main thing there. But, yeah. I mean, in general, also, the thing is about VR is, like you were talking about this, the underlying thing is that, to me personally, VR is a tool and it's not an entertainment medium.
Yeah, I don't see it as an entertainment medium. I think of it definitely. I mean, I've said this a million times. I'm sure people are tired of it, but it's definitely a key. Like architecture is like one of the best examples out there.
Sure.
Yeah. Right. Mm-hmm. Of it, it is a tool that is absolutely going to be a game changer for the architecture world because it's completely natural to work in that space. But I have also been told by other people, like some of the people that are, you know, like Mariantina, that she was talking about some of the stuff they're doing with physical therapy that I would never have thought of, which is awesome.
Right.
But I don't necessarily, you're right, I don't see, I have a problem with the concept of narrative in VR. Mm-hmm. You know, people like, I'm going to make a movie in VR. I'm like, why?
It's disrupting the language that film has developed, and we're just trying to like...
Doesn't matter. Like, why would you do that? Mm-hmm. I don't want to put... The thing is, the argument I always make is that VR is a first-person experience, mm-hmm. and films are a third-person experience.
Yeah.
And that doesn't... Third-person experience doesn't mean it's a lesser experience. It just means it is a experience that you watch and have empathy for, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah, right.
Right? And that's that. Your emotions come from empathy.
Sure.
Right. And that's the... Or laughter, or sadness, or mad, or excitement. Everything. It's all, you know... Your empathy, mm-hmm. and that is a very powerful emotion. Sometimes more powerful than personal experiences.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so that's where film lies, and it's a third-person experience. And VR is all about like first-person experience.
Right. I always point to like one of the first things I did was a horror experience, and I remember just kind of
but you see that kind of makes sense a little bit to me.
Well, I remember like you know the momentum's building, and I'm looking up at the ceiling being like, look at the ceiling. It's nice detail on that ceiling. And right as I look up, the monster pops out and I'm like, oh, I should have been looking where the monster was. Like, and there's, everyone's trying to bridge this path of leading the eye, leading you to where they want you to look,
right,
that you get from film through the language of film.
Right.
And that doesn't exist in VR. And there's a lot of people say, well, you lead them through cues like sound, but it's just, I don't know if it's going
to
get there.
Why? I don't even know why it needs to get there.
Yeah.
I don't know. Like what? I get it. I mean, there's a lot of people in the film industry. Here's the thing, right? The thing I always say is like there's a lot of people in the film industry have gone into VR because they've been disillusioned by the film industry, especially in the visual effects world.
Sure,
right. So the only thing they know how to make is movies. So that's what they think is going to be the right tool. So,
yeah.
Hey, you were mentioning, speaking of people leaving the industry, the visual effects industry, you were talking about some guy on Facebook. He had a letter today about him leaving the industry.
Yeah, I don't know what I should say about it, but it was kind of a heartfelt letter about, you know, the industry kind of, you know, we all know what's going on there. It's kind of a difficult time in VFX and, you know, it's lower wages, more hours, and also work leaving the country. And at a certain point, in his letter, he talked about how, how it affected his life personally, mm-hmm. and everything. So it's a hard time.
So, but I think it's interesting because you're kind of going back into the film industry, but you've gone back on the art director side.
I've always been kind of trying to keep an eye off into the future and see where things are going.
Yeah.
And even in VFX, I think the writing has been on the wall for a really long time.
Yes.
But one thing that I do think that is staying in LA, hopefully, now that I say it's probably not going to happen, but I think that the production, the pre-production and the design it's Hollywood. It's still Hollywood. And so,
well, yes.
And on some level, like maybe you'll have to leave, but for the majority of it, it's all happening here in town still. So it's
good path. Yeah. Absolutely. I think shot production is definitely going to be outsourced, and that includes building sets and whatever else is going on. But I think a pre-production could possibly go there. If they're building a set in Vancouver, dude, you're going to have to be in Vancouver, right?
That's true. Yeah. My wife works at JPL also, so she's not leaving. She loves her job.
Yeah.
And so leaving town is a little difficult for me at this point.
Right.
I know.
So that was one of the issues with me too, for example. Like my wife actually does work. She's a flame artist and she does flame work. But due to the nature of her work, mm-hmm. there is very little chance that that work would go to Vancouver or go to outsourcing places. And I can't really talk about why that is. Mm. But because of what she does, she's successful and will have a job in LA for a while. So if I was told by companies I'd work with, like, well, you have to go to Vancouver to continue your job, which mm-hmm. is essentially what I was being told, I would have to force my wife to quit her job, and that's not going to happen.
Yeah, it's both of us at this point, right? Yeah. So you can't make that decision so lightly. In our 20s, it was like, absolutely. Sign me up. I'm ready.
Yeah, I know.
Now
I know.
As I get older.
Yeah, I don't think – yeah. And so that's funny because there's a lot of people in the VR world that are seasoned visual effects people, right? Because yeah. mm-hmm. I saw it as an opportunity to do something interesting and get out of the whole thing.
I think VR has its place. I think it's an incredible new technology. I think that people need to focus, like I think really step back and don't turn Hollywood into VR and develop it on its strengths, essentially.
Right.
One thing that's driving me crazy is going on to any of these VR stores like the Oculus Store or Vive and seeing promotional content from the Hollywood marketing department, like, all right, we're doing this Pixar movie. Here's the Pixar VR experience, or right. here's this. And I feel like that is doing a disservice. Like the well is getting poisoned from that direction, and it's also getting poisoned from the, you know, cardboard 360 video direction. And yep. so everyone needs to step back and realize what you can do with this and kind of develop it from there, I think.
Well, I believe that the cardboard 360 experience has a role to play as well, honestly, not necessarily the same role, but it definitely has a role to play that I think is going to be important, honestly.
Yeah. Okay.
The reason being, first, just the idea that everyone has VR in their pocket. Yep. They just don't know it, right? Mm-hmm. All they have to do is put something in front of it. And now they have these little plastic things. They're just two little eye glasses and you have your little
thing. Yeah.
It's really chintzy.
Yeah.
I'm not disagreeing with you that it's chintzy.
Well, when I say that it's poisoning the well, what I mean to say is that I can go visit my grandparents and they'd be like, oh, I've tried VR. Right. I got this. And
I got it from the New York Times.
Yeah, exactly. And so, it's not – I feel like if that hadn't been released and people are like, what is this VR thing? And had they put on the Vive or the Oculus for the first time, you'd have this massive explosion of interest.
Yeah, but you won't do that because not everyone's going to buy a Vive. I mean, it's like you're going to have to put tracking devices in your house. No, that's not going to happen.
Yeah,
but the cardboard has a role. And even in the architecture world, like, Let's say you're presenting some big CEO his next new building and his office mm-hmm. and everything else, right? Mm-hmm. And you put him in the Vive and you're like, oh my God, it's experience. And it's like, they're not going to buy a Vive to show everyone else. It's like, by the way, here I've made a cardboard version of this and then you can show this to other people in the office.
Absolutely.
Yeah. You know, and it become, so that's what I see it as. It's like the takeaway version of some certain things. So I think it has a role to play. And I certainly think that mobile VR is going to become big. Like all these big, I bet you Facebook just goes totally 100% invested in terms of technology for mobile VR.
Yeah.
That's
absolutely true. Yeah. What was that? The air conditioner?
Yeah. Okay.
And I think that the big change in VR that's also going to get a big bump in adoption is the social aspect as well.
Sure.
Because that's going to be, you know, in the Vive, there's a program, there's a free app called Rec Room, I believe.
Okay.
And in there, have you tried that one mm-hmm. yet? It's incredible because it's really well done and the graphics are kind of, you know, cheesy, but you go in there, you choose an avatar, you choose your outfit, mm-hmm. and you walk into this kind of gymnasium setting. And it's full of people around the world wearing the Vive right there. Mm-hmm. And, you know, immediately there's like someone from London going, hello. And you're like, who are you? And like you're talking with people and there's people speaking other languages. And, you know, because the Vive is based on where 000 is in mm-hmm. 3D space and how tall you are, there's even kids in there playing. And they're like, the little characters are, you know, only 2 feet off the ground. And you know that those are the kids, so you don't want to talk to them. It's just a really odd communal experience, which is going to change everything as well.
That is interesting.
Yeah.
I do remember, like, oh my God, I don't even remember what it was, but it was years and years ago. I want to think it was around 1995 5 or 6, and it was an app that I found on my PC. This is back in architecture school. Mm-hmm. That was basically Skype, mm-hmm. right? Yeah. It had an ability to do an audio thing connection with someone else. But because it was brand new, and they basically, it's just like you described, it was basically a list of everyone that's on, and you just clicked on a name and called that person.
Right.
You didn't even know who you were talking
right.
to.
Who are you?
Who are you? And that's what I did. Mm-hmm. And then having like this, like I was at studio in architecture school and then having this conversation with this guy from Australia.
Wow.
Who's a software developer.
Yeah.
And he and I were chatting stuff. And so one of these, I'm chatting with this person. I was like, oh, it's going to, and then and you got to realize that this Skype did not exist. Like, yeah. none of this existed
right.
at all.
Yeah.
So these two girls walk into the studio. They were friends of mine. And they're like, and it's like, what you doing? It's like, hey, I'm talking to this guy to Australia. And they're like, hello, hello. Like, they didn't believe me.
Right.
They're yeah. like, this is a computer program. It's like, no, I'm talking to a guy in Australia. And yeah. you have to convince them that it's not, no, I'm not a robot. This is not some weird thing. Like, they did not believe that I could just make a random phone call on the computer.
Yeah, like, it's like those old, like, CB radios back yes. back in the old days.
Yeah,
right?
It was like I was on a ham radio of some kind.
Right.
So, but it is kind of cool to be that in VR. I do agree. I should experience more social stuff because I've been hyper-focused on the architecture side because honestly, from our user point of view, from mm-hmm. the Chaos Group side, architecture like has the most demand for VR
yeah.
and also the most logical requests
in
the yeah. VR world.
I can totally see that.
Yeah. yeah. Mm-hmm. So, all right. I know we're kind of getting close, but I still want to talk about the patent thing.
Okay, sure.
So what's your beef about
Shall
patents?
I start by just yelling in the microphone?
So you did make some excellent point by point about what things about patents and where they go. So,
sure.
So why don't you go into that? Because I thought it was interesting.
Man, how do you enter into that subject?
Well, I think it was interesting because you and I were talking about the state of sort of the Silicon Valley state right now,
sure.
right? There's a lot of tech companies out there that are being valued and funded, venture capital funded,
mm-hmm.
And therefore they are liable to their venture capitalists.
Right.
That's not the right word. Venture capital company. But they are not.
They're beholden to someone.
They're beholden basically. To someone, but that they're not beholden to the public.
Mm-hmm.
So well, like not publicly traded companies. This is more my beef, but I'm going to
sure.
go into it. So they're not beholden to the public. So whatever promises they make don't actually have to come to fruition.
Right. It's like the world of vaporware.
It's the world of yeah. vaporware.
Yeah. It's just a crazy time. I've listened to a few podcasts on the subject, and it's like what I've heard is that as a Silicon Valley developer, you'll create a piece of software.
Right.
And then at the very end of your development cycle, a patent lawyer is going to come in and
right.
they're going to kind of brainstorm ways to patent their new invention.
Mm-hmm.
And they're going to patent what it does literally. And they're also going to create random names like the matrix of photo sharing ambient occlusion, let's say, right?
Yeah.
Some crazy thing, and it won't make any sense. But because you're filing your patent with a U.S. A government entity,
mm-hmm.
you'll gain your patents that way, your utility patents, and then you have a world of patent trolls that are essentially stifling innovation by basically stopping people from inventing things. You know.
So we talked about this a little bit too, because you're right. Like you said, someone has some random quote unquote invention that they never actually invented.
Right.
They just have the idea of what that is. They never figured out how to do it, but that's enough to actually value their company up because they hold a patent. And
yeah.
then if you want to do that, you have to license that patent.
Exactly. So without stepping on a company's toes, like I'm going to try to tread very carefully
okay.
here, but let's say I had a company that had created a very cool holographic system, right?
Okay.
And I want to gain investment. So essentially I'll create something that gets enough excitement so that I can get the investment. And at that point, when the money comes in, now I've got such a treasure chest of cash that I can actually file patents on a lot of things without actually having to create the full end product. You know, you have a working version, but not necessarily
consumer version. I would love to be corrected on this. Or if there's someone out there as a listener who would know someone who could come in and we can talk about this more, because I think this is interesting. I see this, the difference between these companies that are funded by venture capitalists, mm-hmm. versus public companies.
Sure, right.
Public companies can't, I don't want to say lie, but basically if they say they're going to do something, they have to do it or they're in trouble.
Right, yeah. And this obviously is a layman's point of view of this, because I don't really understand all of it.
But venture capitalist companies are like, we'll just patent what you said and then move on to get more patents for something else.
Yeah, which is essentially a patent troll at that point, because the goal is not to have an end result. The goal is to be able to reap monetary reward when someone else is kind of stepping on your patent.
So these billion-dollar unicorns that are popping up every, you know, couple of weeks over in Silicon Valley, they're also basically just sitting on a trove of patents.
Yeah, and there's some really famous patent trolls out there that have these, you know, these armories of patents. And then even, I mean, it was famous when when Apple went up against Samsung for their phone dispute, mm-hmm. it wasn't essentially just a single dispute. They go to the courts and they bring all their patents and they kind of, like a game of Battleship, basically say,
but you got this.
Yeah. And then they kind of like go through each individual patent to see who comes out ahead. And so these big companies are searching out patents to build up their military almost, rather than, you know, to develop things. And mm-hmm. so you'll see a lot of like really great, I think they're called bull shots online, where you'll have these kind of fake VFX shots selling these products. But, you won't see them actually deliver in the very end.
Right.
Yeah.
It's just a bunch of vaporware.
Yeah. It's such a strange time.
But
right
I think the other argument you made, which was interesting, was like the point of patents, mm-hmm. the whole point of patents was to protect you so that you could get a return on investment on the time you did this.
Right. Yeah.
Right.
To protect
the inventor.
Yeah.
So that was the whole point of the patent. And generally, they're all supposed to expire.
Yeah.
That they're designed to expire so that everyone could take advantage of your invention after you expire and you have enough time to get a return on your investment.
Yeah, but I mean, as with VR as an example, there's a momentum to an industry as well.
Right.
So if you get these time limits on some of these inventions, they're not, you know, some of the public interest will kind of die out at these points and say, oh, it's not working or something like that. So it's dangerous from that aspect too.
Sure.
But a lot, you know, there's even like companies out there whose goals are to create patents and never invent anything.
Right.
So there'll be these kind of like warehouses of inventors creating things. If they have a working version in this place, mm-hmm. they'll file the patent on that and put that into their treasure chest as well.
Right.
And so, and then they'll wait for someone to come out with this new version of a blend. And then they'll say, sorry, we already invented this blender. We hold this patent, pay us X amount of money. And then that's how they make their profit from these things.
But you were also talking about the idea of like, say it stops if some kid, as an example, has an amazing idea, but it involves some patent that would require, it would actually, as opposed to just inventing something that doesn't work, he's actually inventing or she is inventing something that would work, mm-hmm. but part of the invention incidentally happens to have been patented by someone else.
Yeah. Then your best option at that point is to get purchased by that company because you don't want to get sued into bankruptcy at that point. So it's a minefield that you have to navigate through really carefully.
But do you think, let's go back to VR, because don't you think that that's sort of also another problem in VR, in a sense that VR is so new and there's so many VR startups right now. And all of them have got their quote unquote secret sauce, but they may, because they're being so secretive and they want to patent everything, mm-hmm. they are actually all inventing the same thing.
Yeah. And so essentially, then you get worried about who's got more money to be able to fund that kind of thing.
Or what? why don't they work together?
Yeah, you know absolutely. What I mean? Well, that's why, you know, a lot of people say that's what's so great about the independent developer community, because it is more of a community of creating these things.
Open source is awesome.
And I think we can look at history also from this, when they were developing the computer, and then this, and as Wozniak and all these guys are building this stuff, there's this guy named Bill Gates in the background being like, maybe I can make a small little company out of this. Like mm-hmm. it's, you know, it's, there's always that person that wants to turn it into a money-making business rather than a community. So it's a matter, it's like, you know, it's just navigating a minefield.
Did you ever see, it was the miniseries, because there's a lot of, obviously, the Steve Jobs and Bill Gates stories have been done many times. Mm-hmm. But still, in my mind, one of the best ones was a miniseries. I think it was on like TNT, probably like 10 years ago or something like that. It's called Pirates of the Silicon Valley.
I remember that. I never saw it, but I remember.
It was so good.
Really?
It was really good. Now, it just has like, it's not like super well directed or everything else.
Yeah, low production value.
It's low production. It's a mini series from the 90s. So but the historic points that are made throughout there are mm-hmm. so key. And they had one of the guys was what's the name? Bauman. Mm-hmm. You know, the Microsoft guy, right? Mm-hmm. But he was a narrator, quote unquote, of like what Bill Gates was doing.
Right, yeah.
And it was really interesting because they showed like a scene where he goes into an office and he's talking to IBM, right?
Yeah.
And IBM like makes computers, right? And he's like, so you want to give us, you know, this operating system? He's like, no. I'm not selling the operating system. I'm going to lease it to you. Mm-hmm. And like, well, that doesn't matter. We make computers. That's where the money is.
Right.
And then it cuts like to Bauman. He's like, see what just happened there?
Yeah.
That changed history.
Yeah.
That suddenly made software more valuable than hardware.
Yeah. That one moment. Yeah.
And it was brilliant because what Bill Gates did is he empowered software by doing it that way.
Mm-hmm.
Just the concept of leasing software is so different.
Yeah.
You don't own the software. None of the software that's on your computer is owned by you.
Yeah, right. You're just leasing it like
You're
a car.
You're leasing it, meaning that you have no rights to it. Because if you owned it, you can do whatever you want with it.
Sure, yeah. Yeah, that's crazy.
It's like when you lease your car. You can't modify it.
Yeah. It's not yours, per se.
Right.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I think it's very interesting, the whole thing. I don't know what the whole Silicon Valley thing is going to be and what patents are going to involve. But
yeah, I don't know what the answer is. But I think the reigning kind of point is that, you know, artists in general, developers are artists also, mm-hmm. and artists in general are we're always pretty bad on the business side, right? That's what the lawyer's for, and that's what the business manager's for, and so it's always just a matter of like stepping outside and figuring out how you can kind of take care of yourself. I think.
But I think there's got to be a balance at some point because there's obviously companies that are completely run by engineers or business people are not creative companies, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so where is the balance why isn't there a balance and why is there a conflict, right?
Yeah. Yeah. We've all heard the stories about these empty buildings in Texas that are company names, but there's nothing inside the doors and they are patent holders, patent trolls essentially.
Right. Yeah. What's that podcast?
I think that's a great podcast.
This American Life.
And it's called When Patents Attack.
Yes.
Yeah. Everyone should listen to that podcast. Doesn't matter what you do. It's probably my favorite podcast of all time.
I listen to it I will warn everyone, it's very hard not to be furious.
Yes.
When that podcast is over, you are going to be so angry.
Yeah, which is why I was yelling before me and you met up, right, about this whole process.
Yeah, I think it's important. I think people need to realize what's also important to me, and the reason I was brought it up is like when I see sort of the vaporware stuff that mm-hmm. we're talking about earlier, and people get very upset about like, oh, well, this person just made something that's they never came through on or mm-hmm. whatever it is. I tried to take it from my perspective, realizing like that person that is developing software is not acting like us. Like I'm using us Chaos Group as an example, right?
Sure.
We're a privately owned company. Mm-hmm. We don't have any venture capitalists. Mm-hmm. We are in such to ourselves. So our value or what we value is continuing to develop our software that our customers use. Our customers are like the number one thing that makes our software great.
Right.
So we need the value of our company to us is happy customers, more customers, bigger customers, whatever that is, right? Yeah. It's all about customers. The other companies, for example, may not necessarily have that priority because to them, customers only represent a small percentage of what their value is. If they make a patent, it's equivalent to hundreds of thousands of customers.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then they don't need those hundreds of thousands of customers. They just got a patent. So they'll just keep making patents and the value of the company goes up based on vaporware.
It's so, oh man, so aggravating.
So totally aggravating.
True. Yeah.
Yep.
But I mean, and I, you know, some of that kind of holds true. Like V-Ray has stood the test of time also, though, which is, you know, there's some honesty there that you can appreciate.
Isn't it weird? Because when you and I, you know, when you started at Sway and V-Ray was just kind of getting bigger in the visual effects world or in the CG, like, you know, it was used in architecture for a while, but it was just getting there. And they were still like just, it was the rebel renderer, right?
I can very clearly in my mind remember the very first Chaos website, and it was about the time that Brazil was really huge, and I was like, this is going the way of Bones Pro. Like, this is like not, this is not going to be around, because it was just, it didn't, the website was so cheesily made, like just based on the quality of the website itself. And then over the years, you watch this thing kind of like beat out everything else, and kind of just, it's like this, like the slow and steady, you know, the tortoise and the hare kind of thing, essentially, is a really good
Well, I think that the way that Peter grew it also was very cool, because he grew it, just Vlado and Peter, for as long as he could, that they knew that they had enough customer base that he could slowly grow. Because it was like two people for a very long time, and it was like six people, and then it was like 12 people, and then it was 25, 30. Mm-hmm. Now it's over 200 people in the company, and six offices around the world. And that growth is not based on craziness. That growth is based on the need. There's a need for that, right? Yeah. We have so many things. So I think
it has a cult-like following too. Like, people stay with this, right? You don't you don't see V-Ray announcing this new crazy thing that it's going to do. And people are like, have you seen that you can have real-time holograms in your living room thanks to V-Ray? You're not going to have any of that. It's what they develop,
who
they
told you about that?
Or maybe they are. I don't know.
No, well, we do look at some things that are unusual. And honestly, that's part of what I do, right?
But there's an honesty to it. There's a natural growth is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah. You know what I mean? I have crazy ideas all the time. Mm-hmm. Now, the thing is, I'll have those crazy ideas, and then I have Lotto like slapping my head. It's like, what the hell are you talking about? That's not possible, Chris.
Yeah, and if you were if you were someone else, they'd be like, when can we announce this? Tomorrow?
Yes, let's patent that.
Right, exactly.
But it's not possible. That doesn't matter. We'll patent it anyway.
Yeah, yeah. Let's get people talking. Drum up some of that Google money.
Yeah. We don't actually release products. We release press releases.
Right.
Anyway. All right. So this has been cool, Alex. I really appreciate you coming on. I promised you I'll show you some VR stuff. So we'll do some of that. I'll take a Polaroid as well. We'll do the Polaroid.
Nice.
And then that's it.
So, all right, man. It's been great. Thanks a lot.